From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm your host, Kennedy Vinson. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you...
Jazz has always been more than music. It is black philosophy made audible, a sonic archive of resistance, a documentary of diaspora. When Duke Ellington composed, he was coding our humanity into arrangements that white America couldn't legislate away. When John Coltrane ascended through A Love Supreme, he was mapping the spiritual architecture of liberation. And when Nina Simone declared what it meant to be young, gifted, and black, she was refusing the silence that America demanded. Today, two sons of that tradition, one from the south side of Chicago, the other from the church pews of small town North Carolina, carry forward this sacred responsibility. Isaiah Collier possesses the spiritual weight of his ancestors as he channels infinite years of our story through compositions that refuse to let us forget or be forgotten. And Louis Cato, a multi-instrumentalist and bandleader, stands in one of mainstream America's most visible platforms, leading the house band on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He translates the DNA of black church and blues into arrangements that refuse assimilation and reminds us who we are within the music's testimony. Both men understand that every note is political. Every improvisation is refusing the script that they wrote for us. And every performance is a refusal to be silenced. Louis Cato, welcome to the show. I am so grateful to be speaking with you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. At an early age, you were in the church, exposed to different music genres. How did all of those childhood memories really shape your understanding of just black musical traditions?
I mean, it's deeply, deeply ingrained. I wouldn't say... I mean, in my experience, there was not a whole lot of variation of genres like in the churches that I grew up in. But primarily, it was the church, like Saints Delight Holiness Church in Albemarle, North Carolina. It was very like stomp, clap, gospel, spirituals. If there are musicians, it was either myself and my mother, or one of us, or both of us, and sometimes Brother Bobby Crump would come in and play piano with the choir. And you know, other than that, it was just like, you know, stomp, clap, and a room full of people just, you know, that all know the songs and jump in on harmonies. And and I think the way it connects to the way that I would eventually sort of connect to other styles of music is that it is sort of the base ingredient, if you will, for popular music as we know it today. You know, it's very steeped in, it's sort of synonymous with blues. There's always been the tradition of either either frowned upon or embraced of between blues music and spiritual gospel music, and they're very intertwined. And so when I eventually left home and began to be exposed to all these different types of music, like pop and funk and jazz, I was like, oh, actually, there are the threads of this that bear resonance to where I came from. So I feel like it was sort of like I had a little cheat code, if you will.
When you talk about rediscovering your voice and the journey of that, for you, what does that feel like now? What does that look like now for yourself? And also to any other young Black men who are musicians, what would you say, who are also on this journey of rediscovering who they are in their artistry?
I'd say for me, part one, it feels like catharsis. It feels like therapy. It feels like a really spiritual thought experiment. The thought experiment being, what would happen if you let go of all of your ideas about how you're supposed to be and just be? And a lot of, like you were mentioning before, this my song Black Man Blues, a lot of that song is actually about sort of these things that as a Black man that you learn to, for your survival, both physically and spiritually, you learn to sort of put up these walls and safeguards and, you know, mind your tone, be seen, not heard, don't be too aggressive, or make sure you're not perceived as too aggressive. And all these things are what I wanted to express in that song, but it pertains to your question directly, is sort of like the double-edged sword of these traditions that are passed down, that, you know, are a lot of which are the reason that I survive and I'm alive, but also what got you here won't get you there. And there being a fuller, more less inhibited version of yourself. So what it feels like to me is sort of like this catharsis of allowing that ball of yarn to unravel a little bit, and being okay with just what is, how you naturally show up in the world.
All my life I've been told I am, which way to go. Ask no questions, learn your lessons, trust and obey. To survive.
You're currently listening to Black Man Blues, an original by Lewis Cato.
Be seen, not heard. Just remember who done sent you. Mind your tone.
You play bass, drums, guitar, so much more. You're so versatile. How do you see this versatility really connecting to the tradition of Black musicians who historically had to be utility knives to survive and thrive in the music industry?
Yeah, I mean, well, Sammy Davis Jr. is the first person that comes to mind. When I think you can't talk about the need to be a utility guy, multidimensional, multi-instrumental. He just did it all, played all the instruments, sang all the songs, danced all the dances, tapped all the taps. I mean, just like a hostess with the mostest. Huge shoes to fill. But I think, you know, like guys like him and like your Duke Ellingtons and your Cab Calloways and even before that, like the blues guys, like I think of like Robert Johnson and Mississippi John Hurt. A lot of these guys, in order to sort of like perform and make a living, which they weren't getting paid well. I just actually, this reminds me of a conversation I had with Buddy Guy a couple of months ago. We had him on The Late Show. And he was telling me that it wasn't until he was in his 50s that he started actually making a decent amount of money as a musician. And immediately it just brought so much into perspective, because he's about to turn 90 next year, and you know, we all know that his incredible body of work. But if you saw the movie Sinners, that was him in the you know, the character was largely based around in the end scene. But it just immediately put into perspective how much those guys paved the way by being able to be self-contained, and that required like knowing something about other instruments, a lot of which, like when he's performing solo, was just like you had to be your own drummer with your foot on a wooden stage. A lot of like the blues guys playing with thumb picks in your nail, because it needs to be percussive to occupy the role of like, you know, the rhythm that, you know, to translate to recording. And it just, you know, I think that would eventually expand into, as you get to church musicians, you know, having a lot of my church musician colleagues grew up in spaces where, in churches where everybody wasn't always at church every Sunday. So you just, whatever instrument is, you know, no one's there, or that's what you're going to play, and you just figure it out. And that birthed a whole generation of young black multi-instrumentalists, which are now, it's beautiful to see, are now some of like the world's foremost music producers now, because that multi-instrumentalism lends itself very naturally to music production. Ultimately, I feel really grateful that the way was paved by these guys that went before and were their own bands before they could afford bands.
Absolutely. And you're continuing to pave the way, now leading the Late Show Band. You're in one of the most visible positions for a black musician on television. I'd love to just dive deeper into how you feel within this own part of your journey, but really the depth of black musical culture, and how you're able to bring it forth to mainstream audiences and just allowing accessibility to diverse audiences too, because you stay true in your roots. And I'd love to hear about that and just continuing to be authentic through all of your versions of self-expression.
Oh, wow. I really appreciate that. That's really encouraging, because that is 100% my intention. You know, I feel like I can't even begin that answer without talking about the incredible example that John Batiste gave me. I had a front row seat for 7 years of what unabashed, unadulterated black man on camera existing as himself looked like. And it that really left a lasting impression on me and sort of shaped a lot of the way that I still approach it to this day. I watched him find this balance of, you know, fulfilling the needs of the show, which is a variety comedy late night television show. So the energy has to be at a certain level, and the timing needs to be at a certain level, and the support of our host needs to be at a high level. But he also struck that balance of not really ever going outside of himself to accomplish these things. So he's from New Orleans. He brought a lot of New Orleans to it, you know, and there's so many examples of things that the music that the show needed, that he would be like, all right, cool, like, let's put it over a bambula, you know, NOLA street beat, a second line, and really find a unique balance of doing both. Now I'm from North Carolina, so I think that timbre changes a bit, but when I on days when I feel like we've really found that struck the balance authentically, it comes out pretty countrified, pretty southern. To keep our audience engaged, like I was saying, things kind of had to be at a certain energy level. So I like taking songs that are familiar to, the Late Show's audience, a broader Americana, middle-aged mostly audience, and then flipping them on their head and put them over like a backbeat, over like some country, over some rhythm and blues. Like we'll do it to anything. Dolly Parton. I we just took The Sound of Silence the other day, which is very like Simon and Garfunkel, like "Hello, darkness, my old friend," and we just put it over. "Hello, darkness, my old friend." That is 100% of the intention, just to do the job, in a way that is authentic, to us, to me leading it. In a way that does like fulfills that cultural sense of responsibility to keep this lineage alive.
Louis Cato, oh my goodness, thank you so much. It was an honor to speak with you, and I'm so excited to see all of the incredible things that you continue to put in this world and yourself too.
Kennedy, thank you so much for it's been one of the most encouraging interviews ever. Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much.
Both griots of ancient tradition and conscious storytellers, these are the sounds of young Black men who refuse to shrink and play anything but the truth. Isaiah Collier, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining me.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Kennedy.
You started playing saxophone at 11 years old. What initially drew you to this instrument? How do you explain your relationship with the sax within your artistry and how it's evolved over the years?
I didn't even know I wanted to play the saxophone initially. I remember I was at a music camp and they were giving us our choices to select what instruments we wanted to play. I saw the trumpet and I was just like, three fingers, that's it? Yeah. Clarinet. I wasn't a fan of Squidward. My younger brother was a drummer already. And then my older brother at the time had actually had a saxophone. He was going to play alto as well. And I was just, I guess, I thought I was nervous, but I kind of looked at everything else. I was like, well, I don't know. I kind of like wanted something that wasn't too brass, but not too reedy. That's literally what the saxophone is. It's the merges between that brass and woodwind dynamic. But, the other thing was like, I grew up in a musical family and everybody kind of had pre-established voices or certain proclivities to certain instruments. Naturally, more my younger brother, he's a drummer. So like to this day, he's working with Stanley Clarke and all these other great people. Yeah, I remember I was playing and then they decided to graduate me to the tenor saxophone, which was profoundly impactful because they were like, finally, an instrument that could take up all the stuff you pushing out, man. And not only that, but like it was also finally something that I could do exclusively myself. There was no thing that my parents couldn't teach me how to learn this instrument. At this point, if I learned this, if I committed to this, it's because I was committed. Now, then my father, of course, he was a musician, obviously, so he made us play it in church. It was not even an option. I just wanted to do classical, and he's just like, "No, we're going through everything." And then I remember he told me, "If you really want to take this instrument seriously, there's two names you need to deal with, and that being John Coltrane and Charlie Parker." And so, sitting down and trying to make sense of this music that was vintage but still mysterious, and trying to make I don't even know. At that time, I didn't know what I was hearing. All I know was, I can't do that. That's a bit too fast for me. The more I heard it, I got around to the people who did it, and it just naturally piqued that interest, just like as I was learning before. So in that sense, I'm always trying to learn, and just like this instrument has grown with me in various ways, and it doesn't have to be classified as an instrument you only hear in quote-unquote jazz. It doesn't have to be an instrument you just hear in quote-unquote blues. to know that this instrument can fit in so many different dimensions. There is no restrictions of these musical passions. And just like that, I try my best to be as much and as much as of the different conversations sonically that occurs, because it's all about communication.
Growing up in Chicago, and you also have roots in Nigeria, did the city's rich jazz heritage influence you? I know you also mentioned your dad had you guys in the church playing instruments, but also that African influence for who you are today. Did that have a fusion within your artistry as well?
Well, what's funny is I would definitely say the city of Chicago has profoundly been extremely instrumental and how we dissect and approach everything. The city, beyond this reputation that it's known for now, was truly a haven for the creative minds, scientific minds, spiritual, religious minds, all the people from the various walks of life, architecture, you name it, it was all there. And it used to permeate the air. You know, everywhere you go, you could see and feel that vibrancy. As times have passed, yes, those people, those days are no longer around, and then all the systemic things that affected the city, of course, that happened. But its music scene truly took us in, especially the jazz scene, because it was, you know, we're, if I'm being frank, I mean, for those who don't know, the city is infamously known for its redlining and segregation. And therefore, sometimes just like that, these artistic communities can also personify that silently, and not in the sense that it's not because of the race thing, but rather, oh, if you do this type of music, I'm over here. If you do this type of music, I'm over there. Once upon a time, all that stuff was on one square block and you could just hear all of it. But slowly it's spread out more. But the Chicago scene managed to always just somehow find an inkling or a threading, whether it's been like the people who are acolytes of the people like Von Freeman, people who were students of and members of the Advancement Association for Creative Musicians, and even on the R&B side, there were so many different people that were just coming from different churches, all these different things, and then seeing how the intersectionality. But when you hear certain musicians in certain contexts, you're like, I wonder if, and you find out they all came through and hung with certain people. And then, you know, I became more in trance with my West African heritage the older I got. At that time, right, we're still acclimating to being here in the States. My family was from my mother's side is from over in Benin, but that was back in all the way, the 1800s when they finally came here. But all that caused them to adapt to the nuances of enslaved and segregated in post-Civil War America. And so at that time, practicing that was respectfully null and void. but to return back to it, and with a different type of understanding and how it connects. And I think also it allows me to tap into the other creative reserves that we don't consider because we are so disassociated from it. And it's a new layer every time.
Let's talk about your latest album, The World is on Fire. You describe the album as a sonic exploration, blending sounds, consciousness, and activism to raise awareness about the pressing issues of our time.
Ooh, where do I start first? So the album is what I really like to describe as a sonic observation log. I've been writing these compositions over the past 5.5 years. And most of them came out of my time in college when I was attending the University of Pacific at the Dave Brubeck Institute. And during that time, as you know, I'm from Chicago. I've never in my life ever had to experience a forest fire. There was nothing that prepared me for waking up and inhaling and feeling fog in my lungs. And then I'm expected to go to class and perform. There nothing prepared me as I'm trying to drive back to get to school. I might not make it back to school because forest fires are spreading out. And yes, everybody else back home got to worry about the crazy winter. But now it's like, are we really considering what's going on? I was learning also how divided the news is, and that every bit of the news that you watch is regional. there was so many great discoveries and stuff that was happening. I was founding out in California, and I'd be talking to people back home, and they didn't know anything I was talking about. And just like that, that's exactly how we maneuver in the world. You tell somebody this is going on, you sound like a conspiracy theorist. Actually, if you go on the news, but oh, you can't go on that news there because you don't, that's not your region. Certain things you just won't know unless you're there. And so not only that, but then at the time I was in college during the height of the first Cheeto administration. And at that time, when he got into office, I remember hanging out with so many different people, and then those people just vanished from ever hanging out. The exfoliation of racism was showing itself. And then all the stuff that was going on during the pandemic. I remember I was present for the George Floyd protests. I was there at that demonstration. I was there seeing them chase people like wild animals. You ever seen people running from a stampede? Like how you see wildebeest? That's what it felt like. And just hearing the screams, the carnage, the rage, the pain, feeling every human emotion all at the same time, it just made you feel extremely combustible. Like as if like we're all just like this volcano that's ready to erupt. And when it did, it did. To see that how much this country's complicity was showing up, and that we were all just collectively educated to be ignorant. You know, it's a collective hug, if you will, for making us realize we're all in this. We are all wondering the same things. But I also know this isn't the first time this has happened in human history. So we got a choice.
And with that choice, what is your hope for your music and the legacy it's going to leave in truth for this world?
My personal hope is actually really simple. It's to make something that's never been heard before. I don't know what it's going to be. But yeah, I just want to make something. Make something impactful. Make something that's enduring. But honestly, I just want to hear something that we have never heard. Ideas are something that we've all circulated. But like, what's a true original thought? That's how I feel about music. That's the same question I'm asking myself. So yeah.
Isaiah Collier, thank you so much. It was an honor to speak with you. And I'm very excited to see a sound that you've never heard yet.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
To stay in touch with Isaiah Collier and all of his future work, you can now stream his latest album, The World Is On Fire, and connect with his new series called The Etiquette Sessions, located in Chicago. For Dialogue, I'm Kennedy Vincent. You're currently listening to The World Is On Fire by Isaiah Collier and The Chosen Few.